across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello there. We really appreciate you downloading this podcast from the BBC. And don't forget, we're here fighting for you every day of the week. If you want to contact us, nolan@bbc.co.uk. I hope you enjoy today's podcast. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. If you've got the colds and the flus and the RSVs and all that goes with it, COVID, we'll be talking to the chair of the BMA with advice for what you should do and indeed the pressure on the health service because of it. Our top story today, Elizabeth fostered Kevin from when he was just 9 years of age. Kevin is blind, hearing impaired and nonverbal. At 18, he had to go into supported living that his foster mum Elizabeth says they were told would be his forever home. Well, not so. Now, at the age of 33, because of his needs, the Southern Trust attempted to move Kevin, giving him just 1 week's notice that they were doing it. So imagine that. Imagine right now being told, by the way, you're out of your home next week. No notice. Now, Kevin can't speak for himself, but we can, as can his foster mother, Elizabeth. She's been speaking to me, and she told me about Kevin.
Kevin is 32. He's blind, non-verbal, and severe learning disability. Kevin was living with us from, we fostered him from he was 9 till he was 18. He went into supported living, which was ideal for him, that was recommended for him. He's his only room, and there's only 3 other clients in the house that he's in. Kevin could do very little for himself. He needs fed and that, but the staff has been very good up at the living support place that he's in. And they're looking now. We went to his review last Thursday. The review was going well, and then his health issues come up that he needed his bloods done. Kevin will not tolerate anyone taking bloods from him, but he's that sort of child he is. And they said that in the next breath, they said, he's moving to a nursing home. And I said, no, he's not. And they said, yes, next week, rather than this week. And there's nothing in Kevin.
And there was no notice about this, was there?
Nope. Nothing, but just dropped to me just like that at the meeting. No.
And how long has he been in the home for?
He's in 14 years in the living support.
In this same home?
In this same home, 14 years. And the staff know him and the staff are more than good to him.
So hold on a second, because I want to make sure I'm getting this right.
Yep.
So Kevin, his home, he's been living in for 14 years.
Yes.
And they suddenly decided, the Southern Trust suddenly announced, not just to you, but this is impacting on Kevin, that he would have a week's notice before he's moved to a completely different place.
Yep, yep.
And they think that's compassionate, do they?
Well, I don't know what the thought it was. But you wouldn't even take a dog to a kennel without shouldered around it for a few times, would you? I don't know. I honestly don't know.
And when you said to them no, what did they say?
Well, he has been assessed for a nursing home. He's been assessed for that. And seemingly he's been assessed as last 2 years, which we knew nothing about either. Like, Kevin pays his housing benefit or gets housing benefit for where he's living. So in the eyes of the law, I suppose he's a housing executive tenant, but the trust runs this building, you know what I mean?
Why would they do that to someone?
I have no idea. I just said to him, you've somebody else for Kevin's bed. That's what I said to him. I was heartbroken. I just said, I just said that you have someone else for Kevin's room. That's what I said.
You said what?
I just said to him, you have someone else for Kevin's room. That's why you want him out of there. And they said, no, that wasn't it.
Has Kevin got capacity to understand?
Nothing. No, no. Kevin plays his keyboard. I thought he plays a wee bit of music. He loves music. Loves when it suits him, touching him. He plays the keyboard on and off all day. That's his life. That is his life. He's no quality of life at all, but he's not nursing care.
But Would he have the capacity to feel emotion about being driven out of his own home with just a week's notice? Like, would he?
He would be distressed, and he'd be lashing out, and he'd be kicking, and he wouldn't know. He would stop eating, and he would stop drinking. He has to know the person is feeding him. He has to know, you know, he talks, goes by the feel, your touch and your voice and your smell. That's his life.
And did you not say to the Southern Trust, why didn't you give us more notice?
No, I didn't. I didn't say anything. I broke down and left the meeting. I was gobsmacked, quite honest. That was enough to understand. I wasn't gobsmacked. I was so annoyed for him.
Are you sure? Are you sure you're getting this right?
Positive.
That someone has been living somewhere for 14 mm-hmm. years
yeah.
mm-hmm. is told you're out in a week.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what told us.
And they can't speak for themselves.
No.
They can't fight for themselves. But the Southern Trust taking them from their home that they've been familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And presumably familiarity is part of Kevin's safety.
Yes, it is. Yeah. He can come out of his room on his bum. He'd walk if you hold his hand. But he could come out of his room on his own, into the hallway and feel around the place, and if he likes what he sees, he'll sit there for maybe 10, 15 minutes, half an hour, and then he'll bump back into his room and play his keyboard. But the staff up there, Stephen, I can't say anything bad about the staff up there. They are absolutely brilliant. They really are, and they were gobsmacked as well.
Now, the Southern Trust, in their public statement, they mm-hmm. say Trust staff have and continue to liaise directly with Kevin and key individuals in his life around his specific needs. So they are telling the general public that they have been liaising with you around your son's specific needs. Is that true?
Stephen, he's not my son. We fostered him. He's not my son. But Kevin has no one to speak for him and no one to care for him.
Well, they're talking about you, aren't they, when they talk about key individuals in his life. They're talking about you.
Now, this week, whenever I've got in touch with you, my phone hasn't stopped the Trust trying to backpedal. They're saying there's no... It shouldn't have been said that road. It shouldn't have approached the subject like that whatsoever. It was a misunderstanding, and Kevin would be gradually integrated into a nursing home.
Oh, so they're backtracking now, are they?
Mm-hmm. Just because you've got in touch with them, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Why would they do that? Like, it's not good enough, is it? That
it's not
of the Nolan Show intervening that they're suddenly saying, oh, well, hold on a minute.
Yeah.
We'll not do that to him then. Why were they doing it to him in the first place? There's something I'm quite concerned about here, because this is a public body. So mm-hmm. they also say in this trust they've given to this statement they've given to the Nolan Show, this is a Southern Trust, they say, all decisions in relation to placements are based on assessed needs and consideration of best interests, and involve key workers, individuals, their families, key individuals, and independent advocacy. So they are. There's the clear inference there
mm-hmm.
that among the people that they have been discussing this with is you.
Yeah.
Is that true?
They have stopped us up. That meeting, that was all. If Kevin was sick up in Ireland, I mean, they would let me know. The girls would let me know if he needed, if he was distressed, I think that they would let me know. You know what I mean? But no, definitely not. The move was not mentioned to me at all. And even the advocate, disability advocate girl, said it shouldn't have been brought like that to the meeting.
So Kevin, consideration. So this trust, the Southern Trust, mm-hmm. are telling the public that the Kevin's best interests have been considered by them talking to key workers and people like you. Have they sat down and discussed this with you at length, and do you feel like your views have been considered?
No, I don't. I don't think Kevin's or anybody's views have been considered. Stephen, if Kevin needed nursing care, I would be the first to say that's where he should be. Oh, hand in hand, I would say yes, nursing care is what he needed, but he doesn't need it. He does not need it at the minute. Definitely not.
What will the impact be on him?
Oh, I don't know. I couldn't see him lasting too long. I would say it would kill the pervy fella. I don't think it would.
No, why is it, how's it going to? It's not going to kill him, is it?
Well, he would stop eating. He would get distressed, and God only knows what would happen to him. Kevin's not very big. He was the height of an 8-year-old boy, and very, very thin. And all he wants is somebody to love him, look after him.
So you say that they've started having a completely different approach now that they know that the Nolan Show is watching them and what they're doing.
Yep.
So what are they now offering?
Well, they're going to gradually integrate and introduce Kevin to a nursing home. The staff from the nursing home will come up and see Kevin and get to know his wee ways and that. I went to see the nursing home yesterday that they were talking about, and it's lovely, but it's not for Kevin. It's not for Kevin. And they said to me, it's in Newry and that. I don't drive, it's Stephen, and it could be Dungannon or somewhere like that. He could end up with an emergency if he hadn't needed emergency nursing care.
So you're going to find it difficult getting to him now, are you?
Not at the minute, not because my husband drives me over to Bessbrook to see him.
No, but if they move him.
Oh, God, if they move him. If they move him to Newry, that's okay. But the home in Newry is not suitable for Kevin because he doesn't like being in the crowds. He likes his own space. It's not for him. It's not for him. He's happy where he is.
Has any of this been discussed with you?
What's been discussed with me?
The impact on you as a family, him being moved to this new location. Has any of this, have they sat down and talked this through with you and listened to you?
No, I don't think they do. I don't think they listen. So I think they're just, I think they just, he's moving.
So what are you asking me to do? How can I help?
I don't know what to, please just let him stay where he is. If you can get him to stay where he is, to. I honestly don't know what to do, Stephen, to be quite honest with you, or get you to do.
Well, look, we will go back to the Trust again, to the Southern Trust.
Yeah.
And we will ask them to elaborate on why has this decision been made? Why?
Yeah.
All decisions in relation to placements are based on assessed needs. So why can his current home not continue to provide for his needs? Where's the evaluation of how much distress this will cause to Kevin? Has anybody documented that, planned that out? What will the impacts be on Kevin?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think they have thought it out.
Have they sat down and chatted with you in terms of visiting and how you'll be able to get there? Has that been part of any assessment as to what they're doing to Kevin and you?
We can still take him out whenever we want, one day a week. We used to take him out one day a week, and now with COVID, we take him out every other week so that he's clear from COVID and we're not passing anything on to them. We still get him home for a day if we want to.
His family, right?
We are his family, yeah.
I know I said son, but you're his family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the question we asked this trust, why were his family not consulted ahead of plans to move him? And the trust are saying that they did.
Not.
So, well, they're saying they did. So what I'm going to do is we will go back to the Southern Trust and we will ask them specific dates, specific times. Yes. How much did they consult with you? Dates and times of the meetings where they claim they consulted with you. Where are the minutes of those meetings? Why don't you ask? You're entitled to your own data, right?
Yeah.
So why don't you contact, it's not for me to tell you to do this, but you might want to think about contacting the Southern Trust and asking for the Southern Trust for all data about you and the minutes of the meetings where they claim they discussed all of this with you.
Yeah.
We'll certainly have a look at that with you, because they're claiming they've discussed this with you. So let's see the minutes.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
All right.
Okay.
We'll stay across this story. We'll follow up with questions. I'm gobsmacked.
Yeah.
That you're telling us that someone living
their home for 14 years. Yeah. The Southern Trust was giving them the guts of a week's notice before he was being forced out. Who does that to a vulnerable person? Maybe there's a reason, but they certainly haven't given it in their statement. Listen, thank you. We'll stay across this with you. Is that okay?
Lovely. Thanks very much. Bye-bye. Stephen, thank you very much. Thank you. Bye.
Well, look, since recording that, we have been working on this story. Just to repeat, I guess the case for the Southern Trust. Well, I'll read their statement. Well, they say trust staff have and continue to liaise directly with Kevin and key individuals in his life around his specific needs. You've heard the foster mother, Elizabeth, her version of that. She disagrees. The Trust say all decisions in relation to placements are based on assessed needs and consideration of best interests and involve key workers, individuals, their families, key individuals and independent advocacy. I read that earlier. So what we did was we went back to the Trust and we said, look, work with us here, help us understand. Did you only give this vulnerable person a week? And they said they have nothing further to add. We do know that as a result of, it's really Elizabeth's intervention, she came to the BBC, but it's Elizabeth's intervention, we do know that the Trust are now giving Kevin more time before he is moved. And of course we understand that medical needs and professional assessments may dictate that Kevin needs to go into a more appropriate setting. But this story is about communication, isn't it? And this story is about that basic thing that we all get. Imagine anybody listening to this programme being told, by the way, you're moving out of your home, you haven't known about it, but today we're telling you, you're out within a week. So the question still remains to the Southern Trust, whether they want to add to it or not. The question for them still remains is, why would they do that to someone, give someone a week's notice? Why is there no apology for doing that? And are they doing it to others as well? And we'll stay across this story for you. Now, next December, of course, peak time for winter illness to be doing the rounds. And as we told you at the opening of the show today, it's been called a quademic. As know that Ireland is hit with flu and COVID and RSV infections and the common cold. So what do we do if we get it? I've had it. I don't know what I've had, but I've had something. Mum has it, and I'm sure lots of you have it too. One of these things. The chair of the BMA, Alan Stout, chair here in Northern Ireland, has revealed this quademic occurring across the UK. Alan's been explaining what's happening.
Oh, there's an awful lot going around. You can probably hear even in my own voice, I'm a bit croaky. But, I mean, there's so much going around that actually UK-wide, they've come up with a new word, which is a quademic, because there are really four, and probably an awful lot more than four, but four main illnesses that are circulating at the moment and are really affecting people. And those are the flu, and our numbers are increasing at the moment of flu infections. We've got COVID circulating and the new variant circulating. We've got norovirus circulating, which is the kind of tummy bug that people are so familiar with. And then we've got RSV, which you'll probably remember we talked about a few months ago. And this is now affecting not only children, but also older people as well. And it was actually part of a new vaccination program that started just after the summer as well to protect the most vulnerable to this as well. So with all of these circulating, people are getting ill. We're seeing lots and lots of illness and people are certainly feeling the effects of it.
And we don't know which of it we have, right? Is there a crossover in all these? Can you get more than one at once?
You can, yeah, and also one of the problems and one of the things that we hear is that people are iller for longer, and what's happening is people's immune systems are being dragged down, so they're getting an infection, their immune system gets dragged down, they then become slightly more likely to pick up other infections as well, and so you get this vicious cycle and spiral of infections where you might get one to start with, but then you get one after the other, and you can feel very below the weather for quite some time.
So how do you know what you've got? Because we're not going to be able to get access to our doctors, are we? You know, doctors are busy. We will probably ring our doctor with symptoms like we all have, all of the phlegm coming up, we're coughing, we've got a temperature, and we're going to be told to take an antibiotic, are we? Is that it?
No. Okay, so there's so many important things that you've said even in that one sentence. In most cases, you probably won't know what you have, and that actually isn't that important. We don't routinely swab or test for flu. At the moment, if you've got flu symptoms, you're likely to have the flu. We don't routinely swab or test for COVID at the moment, and certainly common cold. We don't test either. But most of these are self-limiting. They are viral illnesses, and the same advice, the same recommendation that we have year on year is keep yourself well, keep indoors, minimise contact, paracetamol and even anti-inflammatories, plenty of fluids. So most you don't need an antibiotic. But if you are noticing that you're becoming worse, and particularly if you're starting to spike temperatures and you're developing a very chesty cough, a lot of mucky phlegm and so on, that suggests that you're quite potentially getting a secondary bacterial infection. And it's at that stage that we would think about antibiotics.
And is that a chest infection when you talk about a bacterial infection?
Yeah, very much. So again, that's the same concept of, as you become unwell, you're more prone to then getting secondary infections and other things coming in, and that can be that chest infection that develops.
And in the fit and the young who are fit, is a chest infection just part of the course of this and not that dangerous? How concerned do we need to be about our grannies and granddads and elderly parents if we start to think they've got a chest infection, they're finding it difficult to breathe?
Yeah, and again, you're spot on. The people that we're most worried about are those that we know are most vulnerable. So that will be the elderly, and that will be those with other illnesses, other conditions and heart conditions and existing lung conditions and so on. So they would very much be the ones, number one, that we would be extra cautious about and possibly treat, a little bit quicker, a little bit earlier, with that caution. But also they're the ones that we have very much targeted with the vaccination programs and trying to protect them. And again, it's worth emphasising, that is the massive, massive value of the vaccination programs, is protecting people, particularly those most vulnerable, from serious illness, hospitalisation and worst case scenario, death, unfortunately.
So what are we looking out for in terms of when we need to be, very concerned? Because I think the confusion in all of our minds, Alan, is we expect to get this now. Like, it's doing the rounds of Nolan teams, doing the rounds of many offices throughout the place, yeah. And then kids bring it home from school and all of that. So we take time off, we stay in bed, we stay indoors, we minimise contact if we can, hard to do in a family, and it should run its course in a couple of days. Is that it?
Yeah, certainly within a week or so it should run its course. You should be starting to feel better. You might not feel 100% better, but you should be starting to notice that you're getting better. But it's over that course of time, if you're getting progressively worse and particularly spiking temperatures and developing other symptoms, and that is that kind of chesty cough, the mucky phlegm and so on, that's when we would certainly be advising that you contact your doctor. The other group, sorry, just to add to the list that you gave there, never forget, this runs rife through healthcare workers as well. We're exposed as much, and if not more, than other people. And it creates a real compromise with our workforce at this time of the year as well, because we potentially have a lot of people off in every different healthcare setting at the moment.
Well, so how are pressures at the moment? Are they the normal winter pressures? How are we coping?
Yeah, nobody is in any doubt that we are about to enter, we are in the middle of a really, really difficult winter. Every part of the service is under pressure. There have been various measures and mitigations to try and minimise that, but the winter in the next few months are going to bring undoubtedly increasing pressures.
Okay. Alan, you mentioned RSV earlier, and no doubt I'd remember talking to you about it. I don't. So what is RSV and who's getting it?
Yeah, so again, RSV is something called respiratory syncytial virus. Again, it is a respiratory illness. Typically and historically, we've seen it predominantly in children. But it is now affecting other people. It causes a cough. It causes those classic respiratory symptoms. So it is quite hard to differentiate. It spreads like wildfire. It has, you'll remember the R number that we used to talk about with COVID, which was how quickly it spread. The R number in RSV trumps that multi-fold. You know, it really does spread quickly. But in most people, it's a very quick, short-lived, self-limiting illness. But again, it's when it starts to affect the elderly population. And that's why there was the vaccination program to protect them.
And just one final question, a practical question. If we've got this, whatever it is, so we won't know what we've got, will we? It's a cold, it's a flu, it's COVID, whatever it is. Because it's so widespread, should we, if we can, should we be continuing to go into work? Because it's going to spread anyway, or is the advice to stay at home?
Yeah, so, I mean, and that's a wee bit like that, the traffic debate, isn't it, at the moment? It is about sensible measures. So, yes, absolutely, stay at home. It'll help the traffic situation too. But, yeah, I mean, if you are feeling unwell, if you're feeling ill, and this has been the advice and the guidance for many, many years, it obviously changed dramatically with COVID. But we've really reverted to the previous advice, which is minimise your contact. So if you can work from home, work from home. You know, if you have to be in work, try and isolate yourself and minimise your contacts in work. You know, and then it is the kind of hand hygiene, the coughing and sneezing. Don't be spreading it through, you know, coughing and sneezing over people. Use hankies and catch
drink
anything
lots
that
of
you
water.
Are. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Alan, thanks very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, hopefully that was helpful for those of you who have got this. You can let us know if you do have it, what your experience has been, or long it's lasted, 03030 80 55 55. And look, remember, if you're not sure, contact your doctor, and if you're developing breathing problems, definitely do so and get the professional advice. We were talking there about pressures on the NHS. The Nolan team has been looking at the waiting times now that have been published for the accident and emergency departments across our hospitals in Northern Ireland. We can see that the waiting time for the Ulster Hospital in accident emergency, obviously you'll be triaged if you are in an emergency situation, but the waiting times otherwise in the Ulster Hospital, 7 hours. The Alt na Gelvin, just over 5 hours. The Mater, 4 hours. The Royal, 4 hours. Over 5 hours in Antrim. Just over an hour in Causeway Area Hospital. Craigavon, more than 5 hours. Daisy Hill, 4 hours, and just under 3 hours at the Southwest Acute Hospital. So that's giving you a sense already of the pressure. Some of those figures have been around, I'm sure. Similar figures have been around, because many of you have been telling us for a long time now about the waiting times in our NEs. We'll pause there, and we'll get the news at 9:33. I'm just listening to that news bulletin there. Why? If you listen to that bulletin, so Eddie Lynch, the Older Persons Commissioner, is leaving today, but a successor hasn't been appointed. So what? Older people now don't have a representative for how long? What? Why would Stormont not have the successor appointed? We're coming into the... Obviously, we're in the winter. Elderly people have had their winter fuel payments reduced. They will have constant representation. So Tesco's can get somebody, or whatever way you want to say it, Lidl, all of these different brands, they can get someone onto a till when one person leaves and the next person arrives. But Stormont can't keep a representative in place for our elderly population. Have I heard that right? So we'll go to Stormont this morning. I'm just hearing that. I'm just realising that in that bulletin today. So our team will go to Stormont today and ask why and how long is it going to take. On behalf of all of you who are elderly, on behalf of all of you who are the children of the elderly, why would we leave our elderly population in Northern Ireland without a representative? 03030 80 5555, number to call this morning. Nigel. Morning, Nigel.
Stephen, morning. Listen, I was just calling. Yes, morning. This quandemic, as you might call it, well, actually, and according to whatever surveillance data is out there, it's predominantly COVID. And according to the World Health Organization, we are still in the COVID pandemic. And you might have thought that all of the lessons that we had had a number of years ago around what we do to stop spreading dangerous viruses that have terrible health consequences for many people, that we might have taken all of those on board, and that we might have had leadership from the Department of Health, Public Health Agency and others. So I'm going to tell you something interesting.
Well, you do have leadership, don't you? Why? What are you criticising them about? What haven't they done?
I'm criticising the issue of a denial that COVID and flu remain serious illnesses. And say
they haven't denied it. Where have they denied it?
Well, there's a denial that we're back to almost normal pre-pandemic situation where we still have an evolving virus. And the issue that is we still...
I haven't seen them say that.
Well, they haven't said that. It's the actions, the culture, the attitude that's taking place. And here's the key fact around that. So frontline health and social care workers in Northern Ireland, who we need in our hospitals. You were talking about waiting lists earlier, the pressures on those services. Partly they come because of workforce illness and so on. So the workforce in Northern Ireland in the health service is eligible for the flu vaccine and the COVID vaccine. Yet the take-up rate, I believe, is hovering around 20% or less. So that means that those people who are getting sick, they're having a more severe illness. Some of them may never even return to work because they have complications and so on. So that's those that are eligible for free vaccination aren't taking it up.
Well, and yeah, but you can hardly blame the Department of Health for that. They would advocate taking vaccines. They would push the vaccine availability throughout Northern Ireland. It's up to the individual staff why they're not taking it. I would need to see that figure. It's
yes,
an interesting figure
should,
if it's true.
That, Stephen,
but you're saying 20% of healthcare staff.
20% or less, yeah.
Well, I want to go and find that myself
now,
and just clarify that is the stat.
There's a difference between advocating and sending out a text to somebody or a poster
right.
in the workplace
well, look, let me,
and a whole
let, Nigel,
culture of yeah,
okay.
investing
well, let
in
me,
that properly.
Let me say thank you for your call today. I want myself to go off and find the official statistics around take-up of vaccines in the NHS. With respect, I don't want to rely blind on what you're telling me around 20%. Let the BBC find that figure for ourselves, and we'll come back to you with what the official statistic is. Norman, good morning, Norman.
Morning, Stephen. Did you get ready
for
your flu?
Well, I thought I did, and then I'm starting to cough up phlegm this morning again. I'm feeling a wee bit dodgy today. The guy across the street from me, one of the neighbours across the street, he's diarrhoea from whatever he has. Mom has it. Yeah, half the Nolan team's been down with it.
Well, you see, Stephen, the reason people are getting it, this time of the year, people are going to office parties, they're going out for Christmas dinners, and they're mingling among crowds. And that's why people are catching it and spreading it around.
Well, what do you want us all to do? Do you want us all just to sit in a darkened room and not go out and not talk to anybody?
I go out shopping. I was down in Carrickfergus yesterday seeing my friends, Harry and Jean. I don't mingle with crowds. I'm going to go to church on a Sunday. I try and stay away from the crowded parts in the church. I sit on one side of the church. So yes. I want to go out shopping. I don't mingle with a whole lot of people in shopping centres.
And you don't go out and talk to people?
I tell them, yes. I've had my RSV job. I've had my flu job. I wouldn't take COVID because a year ago I took my COVID job and I was in bed for 2 days with a bad flu, the reaction from it. So
right.
I no longer take
have...
a COVID job. So I
right,
don't.
But what would you have been in bed with if you caught COVID and you didn't have the job? That's a personal decision, obviously, for you.
But Stephen, if you take a flu, they're telling you you've got COVID. But it's not COVID, it's a flu and cold that goes around this time of the year. It goes around this time of the year every year at Christmas.
But they're not telling you. I think we need to be responsible here.
But Stephen.
Fair
that's all
to the
right,
Department
then.
Of Health. They're not telling you you have COVID if you've got flu, are they?
Stephen,
you've just heard Alan Stout from the BMA sent you this morning that they're not routinely testing for it now. So they're not telling you what you have.
No, but Stephen, it's up to every individual if they want to take a COVID jab. But I had a
Absolutely.
Bad reaction to it, and that's why I don't take it anymore. Because I don't think these COVID jabs are tested long enough for to make them perfect. They're throwing them out every few months, different jabs. It takes about a year or more to make sure that the inoculation you're getting is perfect. So
well,
it
obviously,
needs throwing these jabs out every other month.
Well, obviously, what the government authorities would say is they're not just throwing them out every month, Norman. They're not doing that. And that they've gone through rigorous testing. You are entitled to your opinion, as is anyone else, to question whether you want to take the COVID jab or not. But I'm sure that many medical experts throughout the world would object to any suggestion that those jabs have just been thrown out. And indeed, they would say that the COVID jabs have saved millions of lives. Next. Single-sex schools been ranked some of the best performers in this year's Sunday Times UK Top Schools list, with only three mixed-sex or co-ed schools ranking in the top 10. The Henrietta Barnett School came out on top. It's an all-girls school in London. Meanwhile, a school that caters to both sexes, Friends School in Lisburn, ranked the highest of Northern Ireland schools. Congratulations, Friends. So Dawes being educated, and Friends is mixed, of course. So Dawes being educated without the so-called distraction of the other sex help academic performance. Ex-head teacher Kathleen O'Hare with us today. Morning, Kathleen.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And the former head of history at the Royal School Armagh, David Graham. Morning, David.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. What do you think, Kathleen? Single-sex schools better or not?
No, I don't think so, Stephen, but we have a lot of really good schools in Northern Ireland, and some of those happen to be single-sex. I had the privilege of being a head teacher of one of them for 10 years, and yes, there's something special when you go through the door. If you've never been through the door of St. Cecilia's, there's something really special when you go through the door, and the whole school is built around the philosophy of building self-esteem and caring and everything else. But that's not to say that a school that is not single-sex doesn't have that either, because if you look at Hazelwood College in North Belfast, they have won a huge number of awards for their pastoral care, etc. I think there is something different about being in a single-sex school, as there was in the past, and I don't know if you went to one where there was single-sex primary schools. I don't know if there are any single-sex primary schools left. And I suppose through time we will move to ones, you know, our post-primary schools all being mixed as well. I live in Newry, and all but one school in Newry is single-sex.
Well, if you think of the prep schools for the likes of Inst, I'm quoting Inst because it's my old school, it's obviously single-sex. Inst Marlow is single-sex. The discussion that I'm wanting to have today is there something magically good about single-sex schools, or is there something magically destructive, David, about people when they're growing up and they're learning not being around the opposite sex?
Well, look, I think, Stephen, that is probably in itself a kind of wider conversation. Obviously, you're a former pupil of an all-boys school. I am a former teacher in two all-boys schools, so we're probably looking at our experiences through slightly different lenses. I think what I would say is, I mean, my experience in education as a special advisor is that the number one, the key word is choice, and that's the choice of the parent and the choice of the child. We are in many ways in a very difficult situation in Northern Ireland because we have such a wide range of sectors, but of course that does provide more opportunity. You know, parents will decide to send their children to a small amount, will send a boarding school, some will choose education based on a religious background, or perhaps integrated. I mean, the list goes on and on. I mean, what I would say, if I kind of personalised it for a second, obviously I was on a couple of weeks ago discussing my own son doing the 11 plus, and you know, we are fortunate in Belfast that there is a lot of choice, obviously depending on how the young lad does, but there's a lot of choice in terms of both mixed schools and single gender schools.
Yeah, but you two are kind of sitting on the fence today about this, aren't you? So let's just call it. Which would you prefer, David? Single sex or mixed?
Well, look, I think if you're putting a gun to my head, the mixed gender schools at a lot of times make more sense. I mean, again, if I personalise it, I've two sons and a daughter, so it probably makes sense for me to have to go to one school every day. But, I mean, what I would say is that if I individualised it down, single-sex schools do provide a different maybe style of education. They probably at times offer a wider range of whole pupil activities. And what I mean by that, Stephen, is CCF, sport, things that maybe are a little bit
but
more
why
specific.
Why would they offer a better range or a wider range of activities? Why? Why would they do that? Because it's all boys or all girls?
I think probably just, Stephen, based on numbers. So I think that, you know, from the point of view of you've only so many staff to go around and so many pupils to go around. And I think that, you know, if you look, for example, at if your child is very academic, that there will be schools who almost sell the dream of Oxbridge. If your child is more vocational, there are schools who...
Yeah, but this has nothing to do with sex.
Well, I mean, Stephen, to an extent, I slightly disagree, because I think that there are a number of studies out there that would suggest that both genders are educated or learn in a slightly different way. So I think, obviously, providing a more sort of specific education per gender... Right. Clearly does work, but as I said, I'm not going to die on this hill, even though you probably want me to here, Stephen.
Why, Kathleen, would girls, as they do better in single-sex schools at sciences? Like, why would that be the case?
I think there's been quite a bit of research on single-sex schools, and you did say quite rightly earlier that I had been sitting on the fence. When I was working in a single-sex school, and when I was principal of that single-sex school, I thought it was the ideal. And I still think it's the ideal when I walk in that door, because there was a lot of work having to be done in my early days with girls going on to university, the first in their family to go to university, with them seeing a career and a job being a really good choice for them, as well as maybe a stay-at-home mum. So there was a lot of work that had to be done in a single-sex girls' school of that. And I will still say that a lot of girls, you can create the curriculum in such a way as to make sure that they go on, you know, to certain jobs, which maybe would have been a challenge for them in the past, those into construction, those into technology, you know, where traditionally women didn't work. But boys do well when they are taught with girls alongside them. It makes a different school. It makes at times a calmer school. It's more representative of our society. So, you know, for all of the teachers who teach in a single-sex school, it is an easier job in many ways, but it's probably not how we want our society to be. And if I think of going for 7 years to Newry to a single-sex school, going into university, I was the only girl in my class at university. The rest were boys. It was a bit of a culture shock. I don't think that should happen nowadays, but, you know, as David rightly says, you know, choice is everything. And a huge number of people who their children have gone to single-sex schools, when they grow up, they do the same. So, you know, there is that choice where they want them to be. So girls do better when they're on their own, but boys tend to do better, and it's a calmer school when there are girls there.
Kathleen, thank you. David, thank you. 03030 80 55 55. You can let us know about your experiences this morning. Next, heated exchanges at Stormont this week as MLAs voted to continue with the controversial post-Brexit trade arrangements for at least another 4 years. Unionism put on a united front in opposition to the continuation of the Irish Sea border arrangements. During the six-hour debate, the TUV MLA, Timothy Gaston, took aim at the Alliance Party. Have a listen to this.
We all know what the results of this vote is going to be because of the Nationalist and Republican Alliance. And for the benefit of Hansard, Alliance is a capital A in the phrase I mentioned. The question is, What are you going to do about it? The assurances unionists were given, whether they were in the Belfast Agreement or the Windsor Framework, clearly aren't worth the paper they are written on.
Order, Mr. Tennyson.
In order for Mr. Gaston to refer to the Alliance Party as nationalist and republican when it is clear that we designate in this Assembly as United Community.
Well, we all know how the Alliance Party has designated itself. Mr. Gaston has made a different assertion to that. People are entitled to say things in this House. I'm not here as Speaker to be some speech watchdog. It's the debating chamber. I haven't finished, Ms. Long. I am not here to tell everybody what they're supposed to say. People can say things which are wrong. That doesn't mean that they can't say it. Ms. Long.
It is correct, of course, that people are entitled to hold their opinions, but are people entitled to state on the record things that are counterfactual?
In terms of what the member has said, he referred to nationalists, he referred to Republicans, he referred to the Alliance. That is for the member. How you vote tonight may reflect that. I don't know. It's up to yourselves how you vote. How you vote tonight may reflect that there is nationalists, Republicans and Alliance go through one lobby. That is something you are perfectly entitled to do. That is not a political statement. That is something you are perfectly entitled to do. If the member wishes to point that out, that is something that he is entitled to do. This is a debating chamber where people are allowed to have a go at each other, as they do in other debating chambers across the world. And I wish to goodness that members would be a little less sensitive to being attacked. If you're attacked, get up and make your case against the other individual. I will facilitate anybody to do that, but I'm not going to stand here and say you're not allowed to say this and you're not allowed to say that across this chamber. It is a debating chamber. Take it on as a debating chamber. It is not a student debating chamber.
Much, Mr. Speaker, and we have appeared to touch our own nerve where the Nationalist and Republican Alliance, certainly there's a bone of contention there. Yes, you might not be designated at that, but certainly within unionist circles, that's the perception. And I certainly believe that. And I restate my comment I made earlier about you being Sinn Féin's little helpers, and on this basis you'll trip through the lobbies with them later on, I'm quite sure. So moving back to what I was saying. I will give way because you look cross.
The lobby that I vote through tonight will be based on what I believe and what I stand for. You are no more the DUP's little helper than I am anybody else's little helper. And the member would do well. The member would do well to extend to other people the courtesy that he would expect to be extended to him. I find it outrageous that I have been accused of being a nationalist or a republican here tonight, just as I would find it outrageous to be accused of being a unionist or a loyalist.
Point of order, Mr. Buckley.
Mr. Speaker, could you please confirm for clarity of the House that Mrs. Long is not the Speaker of this House?
I don't think that's a point of order. Order. I don't think it's a point of order. Mrs. Long made her defence, and that's what I encouraged her to do, and she's quite right to do that. Thank you.
Well, that's some of the goings-on up in Stormont. Mick Fealty, Editor Slugger O'Toole, with us today. Morning to you, Mick.
Morning, Stephen.
So Gaston is Timothy Gaston, MLA Gaston, whatever way we want to describe Mr. Gaston. He's causing a little bit of hassle in there, and Naomi getting up, as the Speaker told her to do, and defending herself, and Edwin Poot saying, be less sensitive, get up, defend yourself, this isn't a student debating society.
Well, Stephen, I think it's good to see a bit of passion in the place. We don't see it very often. And actually, I think that, you know, in a way, Stormont's become a little bit too passive. It is the place to have these arguments, and I think Timothy's intervention here augurs for a stronger, larger, and probably more diverse opposition and a more vocal opposition. I mean, attacking rivals is something we see very little of in the Assembly. And yet, that is the stuff of parliamentary democracy almost everywhere you look, whether it's in the Dáil, whether it's in the Parliament of Westminster. And it's not as though the government's record is exemplary. I mean, look at all the infrastructure issues we've got at the moment. Northern Ireland Water isn't able to service housing plans, transit link chaos in Belfast, the Boyne Bridge closure. But what I would say is, from a political point of view, I just wonder whether a movement, i.e. the unionist movement, that's currently in a minority picking fights that reflect concerns, obviously, of their core voters, is simply reinforcing their minority status. Like, and assigning a constitutionally neutral party like Alliance to the nationalist Republican opposition, I think it makes good sense in the flash of the moment, but whether that's actually very wise from a unionist point of view, it lacks a certain kind of farsightedness. As really,
well, why does it? Timothy Gasson's entitled to say it. He's entitled to describe the Alliance Party whatever way he wants, is he not?
Oh, he is, totally. And I applaud the Speaker in that occasion. He clarified that issue, that people have the freedom to say things even if they're wrong. And the point of Parliament is they get corrected in the cut and thrust of parliamentary debate. I think Speaker Coates was exactly right in that.
But it
ruling.
Has raised the more substantive point. Shirley Mick is it has raised this question yet again. Naomi saying she's not unionist, and she's not nationalist, but we still don't know how her party would vote if there were to be a border poll. It raises that yet again. Is that not important?
Well, no, frankly, it's not important because it's not part of the business of the day. The business of the day revolves around whether you're pro-EU or whether you're anti-EU. Now, that does generally, although not absolutely, cut unionist Republican. But once you put the Alliance section in, it's a firm majority of the people who vote in Northern Ireland. And all I'm saying is that unionists really might be better advised to pick other sites that get them back into the majority position, because consigning a constitutionally neutral for now, we'll see when the border poll gets called. That'll be a different matter, and the Alliance Party will then have to decide how it deals with that particular situation then. But for
Mick,
now,
thank you very much.
Yep.
We're going to have to leave it there. We're heading towards the 10 o'clock news this morning. 030 30 80 55 55. The news at 10 o'clock, coming up right now. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today at 4 minutes past 10. 030 30 80 55 55. It's the Nolan Show from the BBC. As you know, if you've got a story, nolan@bbc.co.uk is the email to send it in to the BBC. And we've got a team that fight and fight and fight like, you know what, for you to get your answers. Now next, the leading loyalist, Winston Irvine, is facing a jail sentence after pleading guilty to firearm and ammunition offences. Last week, Irvine admitted a series of offences, including two counts of possessing a handgun and ammunition without a certificate. He was known for his work in community engagement and the peace process. But what do his convictions tell us about loyalism today and the use of public money to fund this so-called transitioning away from paramilitarism? Alison Morris, Belfast Telegraph crime correspondent. Morning, Alison.
Good morning.
So what was this guy doing? What was Irvine doing by day and then by night?
Well, he was actually doing both things by day, actually, because he was caught with the guns in broad daylight. But he had been working for Intercom Ireland for many, many years as a project manager in the community sector. And in that, he would have been in constant contact with politicians, police officers, civic leaders, civil servants. After he was arrested, Intercom sacked him. He tried then to take a tribunal case against him, and he dropped that mainly because the funding for his post was literally just transferred over to a different job. He then started working for what they called
It was the Belfast Cultural Network. It was looking at a programme that was looking at loyalist culture, bands, that sort of thing. He was being paid as the project head for that. The funding for that came through the International Fund for Ireland.
He was being paid for that while he was on bail?
He actually got that job while on bail. The International Fund for Ireland, when I asked them for a statement, they said, well, we didn't employ him, we fund projects, not people, which is dancing on the head of a pin, the project they funded, Winston Irvine worked for. And he got that job after he was on bail. And even stranger than that, in May of this year, that group that he was heading up ran a big gala event in the Crown Plaza Hotel with, I think, around 250 people in attendance, including two senior police officers, two chief superintendents, who attended an event organised by Winston Irvine while he was on bail for serious weapons charges. There was also politicians at that event, and Carla Lockhart attended. She took part in one of the panels that was taking place at that event. Now, can I just say that the actual project itself, when you look at it, it's really worthy. You know, it's about, you know, band culture, people who are taking part in sort of Highland dances, that sort of, you know, you can see that there was worth in the project. But I mean, how they couldn't find someone who wasn't on bail for weapons charges to head that project up would be the questions that I would be answering. And I asked the PSNI yesterday, and it's in the Belfast Telegraph today. They sent me a statement basically more or less defending the fact that they had sent two police officers to an event being organised by a man who was on bail for gun charges, and he has now pleaded guilty to those offences.
So, public money, I'm just making sure this is clear in my head. So, public money, our money, our taxes, is funding events where someone who the Crown suspects there's at least a reasonable case, and it now turns out it's true, he was carrying guns around the country for what? To shoot people?
Yeah.
What else does a gun do? And the police felt that it was okay to attend an event with someone heading that up, who they had arrested for carrying weapons. They think it's all right for them to front up and join in. Is that right?
Well, if you look at there's a Facebook page attached to the group, the Cultural Network group that Winston Irvine was heading up. And if you look at that, there's a video online from that event in May where he is standing in front of a board that actually says rights, roles and responsibilities. And he's making a speech, and in that speech he's thanking all the politicians and the police officers who have attended this event today. He was on bail at the time. I mean, this is, you know, if you try and put this in the context that this was a Republican, if this was, you know, someone like Colin Duffy or, you know, someone else who was on bail for serious terror offences, organising publicly funded events attended by the great and the good, all queuing up to shake hands with them. And, you know, even if we say people have the presumption of innocence, which he did have at that time, albeit he's now pleaded guilty, and also he was caught red-handed. I mean, the guns were in the boot of his car. Even at that, you imagine that in any other walk of life that person would have been, at the very least, suspended from their role pending the outcome of the criminal investigation. Instead, he was being given more and more high-profile positions to work in. And as you said, this is all public money. This is money that's meant for the betterment of that community, of the loyalist community. And yet it's going to someone who, as you say, is, you know, a community worker by day. And not even, I mean, we say paramilitary by night, but it wasn't even by night. He was doing both jobs during the day. And, you know, Winston Irvine would have took that car full of guns, dropped them off wherever he was intent on taking them, and then went straight to another community meeting, sitting in a room, you know, with politicians or police officers or whoever he was meeting that day, and it wouldn't have taken a fizz at him.
What about the argument around the presumption of innocence, that those people, including those police officers and other politicians, if we believe in the presumption of innocence, he hadn't pled guilty at that stage, therefore he was innocent. But well, it does beg the question, why was he not suspended? Why was he not suspended, at least?
We spent weeks earlier on this year talking about Michael McMonagall, the Sinn Féin press officer, who got another job while he was on bail. I mean, are we going to argue that he had the presumption of innocence at that time and so should have been allowed to work with children? I mean, most people in most jobs, if you are charged with a criminal offence, you are suspended pending the outcome of that offence. Okay, there are employment laws which say you can't be sacked because you do have the presumption of innocence, but you're at the very least suspended. You're not then given other jobs, high-profile jobs, and you certainly don't get the mix, you know, with the great and the good and the civil servants and the politicians. And everyone knew. I mean, this case was probably one of the most high-profile cases. I mean, his bail hearing was widely covered. It was the front page of most of the newspapers. It wasn't like anyone didn't know that Winston Irvine was facing these charges. They knew. And the Independent Reporting Commission, report after report after report, has pointed out the hindrance in terms of communities moving on. Communities who are under the jackboot of paramilitary figures is the fact that they see these people mingling and rubbing shoulders with senior police officers and politicians and civil servants. And if you were someone who's a victim of paramilitary crime, would you feel confident to report it to the police when the police are sitting with those paramilitaries, treating them as though that they are some sort of dignitaries, attending events organised by them, shaking hands with them, having meetings with them? I mean, would that instill confidence in you as a citizen, as a someone who lived maybe in a very loyalist or Republican community, to come forward and report someone if you've seen them mingling with that? And you don't see this happening with active Republicans. You don't see dissident Republicans being courted in this way, but we do still see loyalist paramilitaries being treated in this way, as if there's some higher difference in our active paramilitaries. And let us say, right now, there is no doubt that Winston Irvine was an active paramilitary throughout this time. He has now confessed that, he has admitted that, and yet he was still hosting gala events in a plush hotel attended by the great and the good, including two chief superintendents.
Yeah, I'll tell you right now what a lot of people in Northern Ireland will be saying. They'll be saying that's how Northern Ireland ticks. Well, that's what a lot of people will say. Look, we know what goes on. We know how this place works. It's not down any glossy brochure, but this is how it works. But it doesn't stop us all asking why. Why does it work like this?
Like, I mean, I think what we need to separate it. We need to separate out that there are people who were once involved in paramilitary activity and who embraced peace after 1998 and who have worked tirelessly to try and make their communities a better place. And there are numerous people who are quietly working away behind the scenes like that. They're not always in the headlines. They're not always seeking glory for it. But there's an active difference, and we wouldn't have had the peace process without the input of people who were involved, ex-prisoners, combatants, whatever you want to call them. We wouldn't have had the peace process without their involvement. The British and Irish government could not have negotiated peace without the participation of those paramilitary groups. But what at the very least, that funding that goes into those communities, first of all, it shouldn't be channeled through gatekeepers like Winston Irvine, who prevented other people from having a voice because he gatekeeped all the access to that funding by ensuring that he was the person. And I don't actually blame him for that, because, I mean, if he's going to swing the lead and get as many jobs as he can, as much funding as he can, well, then that's his business. I do blame the British and Irish governments and those funders who continually allowed him to gatekeep access to those working class communities, to not allow them to go in and speak to the young people and the women and everyone else, that everything had to be channeled through Winston Irvine or not at all.
Tell us more about the job. While the guns were in the back of his boot and whatever else he was up to, tell us what his actual job was then, his public-facing, publicly funded job was.
Yeah, well, the Culture Network appears to me, and I looked through all of their social media and all of their event literature, and actually the literature that came with that Crown Plaza event. And it seems to be something that's promoting, when it says promoting loyalist culture, as in that band culture, as in the arts and things that are attached in and around loyalism. There was people who attended that event here involved in sort of Highland dance, involved in the sort of Ulster Scots community. It's actually, you know, something that would be worthy in order to promote, because we know that the bands take a lot of young people off the streets. They you know, teach them how to play a musical instrument. There's all sorts of value to that. But what my question would be is, if you come up with something, you think, well, this is a good project, this is worth pursuing, why then do you say automatically, well, who do we need to head this up? Well, let's go and find your man who's on bail for having a boot full of guns. He'll be the guy. We'll go and get him to fund up. Was there no one else who was able to fund to front that group up? Or is this just a matter of people being too lazy to go out into the community and seek
seek out those who are actually trying to better their community instead of allowing the gatekeepers. And that's what they are, the gatekeepers like Winston Irvine, who say, no, nothing happens unless we say so, and nothing happens unless it goes through us. And unless we're getting a slice of the pie, unless I'm in a job, unless I'm getting paid, nothing's going to happen. And that's what has been happening for years. And I've said that numerous times, it's been happening for years. And we have people who are insisting that nothing, that they can't fund a project unless they go to someone like Winston Irvine. They can't just go and seek out somebody else. And bizarrely, at the time, we were told, and obviously he was still on bail at the time, that the protest that took place outside the Shankill Women's Centre when Michelle O'Neill and Emma Little Pengelly visited was organised by Winston Irvine, despite the fact that he would sit regularly with members of Sinn Féin at meetings. He would meet high-profile members of Sinn Féin in the course of his community work. So it was okay for him to meet them, but when they come to the Shankill Women's Centre, he's drawn posters in people's hands and sent them down to protest. Because why? Because he can't gatekeep the funding through the Women's Centre. You know, he can't be in charge of them. They won't kowtow to him. They won't do what he tells them. And therefore, you know, nothing happens without him. And that's what's going on here. It's intimidation of people.
And when you say nothing happens without him, who is he in terms of, where does he get this power from?
Well, he was alleged to be, and we say alleged, but there's probably no need to put the alleged in front of it, given what he's confessed to be the commander of the B company of the UVF on the Shankill Road, and has been for many years. You know, according to my colleagues in the Sunday papers, he's been moved out of that role now and someone else has replaced him, but that's what he was. And then at the same time, he was the person who, you know, would have been standing with a glass of fizz in his hand at an event organised by the British or Irish government. He would be meeting members of the NIO, would be meeting senior officials from the Irish government in his other role as a community worker. And in the meantime, he's still actively participating in paramilitary activity behind the scenes.
And why, sorry if this is a naive question, but I think it's an important one. If these guns were for the UVF, I thought the UVF was on ceasefire. What's the UVF doing wanting more guns?
Well, I would imagine had the UVF and the Shankill not been involved in that attack on Simon Coveney, and you remember the hoax bomb that was placed outside the centre in Ardoyne where he was given the peace talk, I think that was for the John and Pat Hume Foundation that day, and if anyone cast their mind back, you remember Simon Coveney being escorted out by his security and bomb squad coming, eventually it was a hoax bomb, but the poor guy who was hijacked and told to drive it up to the Crumlin Road didn't know it was a hoax bomb. Had that not happened, he would probably still be working away, shaking hands with senior police officers while continuing on his paramilitary activity in the past. I think that was a turning point in terms of the police and also the intelligence agencies dealing with the UVF, because that was highly embarrassing. And remember, that event just wasn't reported locally. We didn't just report it. That was reported around the world. You know, that was an attack on an Irish minister while in Northern Ireland trying to deliver a talk on peace. And that was all obviously attached to those post-Brexit arrangements. The PSNI came out quite quickly and said they believed that was the work of the Shankill UVF. So I would assume since then that maybe the dial was turned up and the people who had been turning a blind eye for a long time to that kind of activity had decided that that could no longer be the case, because it was highly embarrassing for the police and highly embarrassing, I think, for the Northern Ireland office, highly embarrassing for the British government.
But can I just come back to that question? And look, this is really helpful to us, Alison, so thank you for this analysis. Is the UVF not on ceasefire? What are they doing? I know officially, but does all the funding, this so-called transitioning money, which is on the basis of the UVF have stopped, have every intention to stop, and are certainly not amassing weaponry, does this whole story not signal a concern as to why is the money still flowing and why is the UVF gunning up?
Well, what I wouldn't want to happen is, because of the actions of Winston Irvine, the people that really need those funding, you know, those community groups that are doing good work, that they would be penalised for. But what I would say, and this just to me just seems like more common sense than anything else, what I would say is, if funding for any project should be based on that person having to sign off their code of conduct. And if they breach that code of conduct, well, then that funding should be removed immediately. For the International Fund of Ireland to patronise people by putting out a statement saying, we don't fund people, we fund projects. Who on earth do they think they're speaking to? They think we're all idiots. The projects that they're funding are not, you know, the project isn't some entity sitting on its own, operating on its own. The project can't run without people. And the person that they were paying was Winston Irvine. And that was who's being paid from that money. Albeit they might channel it through, you know, two different organisations to try and confuse matters. So when you then go looking to ask for questions, they're sent you in 100 different directions asking for comments. But that money came through the International Fund for Ireland. They give that funding to that project knowing that Winston Irvine was going to be the project lead, knowing that he was on bail, and they continued to fund that project knowing that he was on bail. That should, I think, come with some penalty. When you are facing serious charges, all bets should be off until then you prove your innocence. And that funding should at least come with some sort of stipulation that you sign up that you're going to engage only in peaceful means. And then if there's anyone who's engaging and continuing to engage openly in paramilitary activity, well, then your funding's at risk. And right now it isn't. You know, that's the problem. Right now there doesn't seem to be any proper checks and balances on how this money's managed. But,
yeah. And look, I know you're going to slap me now. I'm being so irritating, being repetitive. But what were the guns for if the UVF's on ceasefire? Who were they going to shoot with them? What were they doing with them? Are they stockpiling them? If they're stockpiling them, what for? What were these guns for?
The guns appeared to have been moved from another part in and around sort of Larne, that type of direction, up into Belfast. And what I can only imagine is, if you cast your mind back to June of 2022, it was in and around a time when there was heightened tensions around those Brexit arrangements, particularly involving loyalists. Were those guns being moved as a sort of safety, security measure in case things kicked off? Was there plans to up the ante? So we've already had the attack on Simon Coveney. Were there plans then to have another attack, another high-profile attack, to try and gain publicity in terms of that, the loyalist opposition to those Brexit arrangements? Well, we don't know, because police did their job on this occasion and they intercepted that car and took those guns. But you can only imagine, if you look at what was happening on the ground at the time politically, and also in terms of loyalist tensions around Brexit, that those guns obviously were being moved in connection, something to do with what was happening at that time.
And would cynics be too cynical to wonder if the intelligence services knew all along what Winston Irvine was up to?
Of course, but only, I'm not even going to entertain that. Did they possibly, or could they? Of course,
well,
they knew.
Well, therefore, was it only when Simon Coveney, in other words, a minister in the Irish government, was affected by Winston Irvine, did the authorities intervene? Are all of the other little people, in other words, the people who live in our community every day, the people who suffer from the UVF every day, did it only become important when someone seemed to be more important than the rest of us, Simon Coveney, was affected?
Yeah, yes, basically yes. Because, I mean, if you look back at the history of the jobs that Winston Irvine has held, he was also on the board of one of the housing associations. And how many times have I spoke to you about the paramilitary control of housing stock in Northern Ireland and the impact that has on ordinary people when they get to say who's housed where and who isn't housed where? You know, we've had this conversation before. So when you're putting people who are paramilitaries on the Board of Housing Associations, he is no longer the Board of that Housing Association, may I add, but that was quite a recent event. What then does that say? If you have someone sitting in police and partnerships and sitting with the PSNI, he's an active paramilitary, what does that say to people? And so, yes, there are people who have been suffering quietly and silently and unable to say, who have been threatened and who have been abused by these groups who are having to pay protection money. All of that there, I honestly think that we're in a situation where there has always been an acceptable level of paramilitary activity as long as those paramilitaries are not in any way threatening or endangering the state or the peace process. And it's only when they step over that line to engage in activity which does threaten the peace or which does cause a threat to national security that we've seen action like we've seen in relation to Winston Irvine. Other than that, you know, I mean, I don't have a magic wand or a time machine to go back in time, but if that hadn't have happened, would he still be working away in the community, being paid, you know, extortionate sums of money to do who knows what? Would he still be, you know, the darling of the Irish government who was being invited to attend events, who had his degree paid for through funding, whereas, you know, on your ordinary people listening to this, look, his son and daughter's at university, he's accumulating vast amounts of student debt. Well, you don't have to do that if you're a paramilitary. You know, somebody will step in and pay for your education for you. Would that still be happening? I would imagine it would be, yeah, had it not been for that attack on Simon Coveney.
And just another few minutes, Alison, I find all of this really important because there are certain questions that people are uncomfortable being asked anymore, or you're accused of disrupting the peace process and everything that goes with it. So the PSNI, you're telling me that they have defended their attendance at an event when they knew Winston Irvine had guns in his boot, and they still went, and they arrested him, so they had to know, and they were sitting at this event with him, and you're telling me that they have defended attending it and sitting beside him. What have they said in their statement?
The PSNI said that police attended to hear about ongoing work to create a framework for a more positive approach to cultural expression, which would directly impact on the planning and policing of forthcoming events. That was their statement. I don't know why they had to hear that from Winston Irvine, but that was the statement that they gave to me yesterday.
So our police force in Northern Ireland think it's all right to sit beside terrorists, do they? Is that in a nutshell? Suspected terrorists. Well, they knew what he was at.
Yes, well, they do. They arrested him. They had the intelligence, and they still felt it appropriate to send two chief superintendents to attend that event, which I found remarkable. And not only that, so cosy was this relationship that if anyone wants to go on, the video's on their Facebook page, go and look at the Belfast Cultural Network Facebook page, and there's a video of Winston Irvine standing on the stage of that event thanking the police for their attendance.
So what does this say about our police force and where the line is for them and where we should insist the line is for them?
Well, I mean, I have reported year on year on the Independent Reporting Commission's reports, and they continually bring this up. They say that there is too close a relationship between some people who are still involved in paramilitary activity and the PSNI, and that relationship is very public because they're seen at events with them. They're seen standing with them. You know, if there is anything happening, we see them whispering to them, you know, on street corners in case there's going to be any disturbances. They negotiate with them. And sometimes people would say, well, there's a least worse option, police. And is it better that police engage directly with people on the ground? Which I actually do think there's merit, and there generally is. But what they do have to do is then say to people, if you're saying to people and investing money in all these ads saying, you know, don't borrow money from paramilitary loan sharks, you know, don't, you know, engage in activity with paramilitaries. You know, we have actually had ads in relation to paramilitary shootings and all sorts of things, asking people to come forward and give information. Well, you can't ask people to do that and then be seen standing side by side with someone like Winston Irvine. Well, how does someone feel confident? They're going to say, if I go and tell the police anything, how am I going to be sure that that's not going to be fed back to the people that I'm reporting? And that's the problem. And that's the problem that police have. I do know that this is probably going to be raised. I'm assuming it's going to be raised at the next meeting of the policing board. You would expect it to be in terms of why police felt that was appropriate to attend that event. And also several other people should be answering questions as to why they felt it was appropriate to attend that event. But what I would say more than that is the people who were funding it should try and explain why they felt it was appropriate to fund him to run that event. Surely there is someone else in that community, in that bands world, in that arts world within the loyalist community, who could have fronted up that network, which to me on paper looks like it's a really worthwhile event and a really worthwhile approach. But why did it have to be him? And I'll explain just what I said to you at the start, because these people treat Winston Irvine as if he was the only way that they could deal with the loyalist community, if they had to go through him. Yeah. Winston, the gatekeeper of the loyalist community. And to me, it's just laziness. It's laziness that instead of getting up out of behind their desk and fighting someone else.
Put the smell test around all of this, especially our police force and what they're doing sitting there. Thank you, Alison. See you all tomorrow. Thanks for listening today. Stephen Nolan Show! Ho, 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 ho.